touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Shuffle One Podcast. We are back to you on an unusual but usual spot. It's been a while since we have been back to you on a Monday night, at least not reacting to a football game. We have, I think, the lowest volume of sports we've had in a good long while, and yet I'm weirdly excited about that. I'm excited that we get to give Cougar volleyball season a bit more time to focus here after the end of the season. End of a season that I think it's just been incredible for us to cover and to talk about Cougar basketball and how maybe not everything in the world is lost now that we're no longer talking about the number one team in the country. We're still talking about a very good team with a very, very big game, Virginia, this coming Saturday. Dustin, where's your head at here on this Monday night?
My head is at thinking about all the Christmas presents that I have not yet purchased and still need to purchase in the very immediate future here. But in terms of the Cougar sports, yeah, I mean, it's kind of tough here coming back talking about three teams that all lost since we last had our episode. So that's kind of a bummer. That's never what you want. But two out of those three teams, certainly not a loss that really stings your pride too much. Certainly programs that we're very excited about and that have a lot to be proud of going forward. So can't be too upset about it nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm going to shamelessly plug something here, but also I think reply to what you just said. I was just talking with our good friend Ryan at Go Cougs, which will be an upcoming premium episode if you want to go to patreon.com/shpodcast, donate a little bit, and give it a listen, because it was a really great talk. And I think something we talked about to kind of contrast volleyball and men's basketball to the Cougar football season, you kind of see whenever you lose a game, things maybe go sideways for Cougar football, you really see the level of buy-in is about an inch deep from the Cougar fan base. Whereas even after the volleyball team having a season-ending loss to Stanford, I think everyone is just so bought into what that program is doing. And even after a painful home loss to Bama, either I've blocked out all the voices that are, or just I think people obviously wish we had won that Bama game, but I don't think anyone's less bought into what Kelvin Sampson is doing. But for one painful loss, I think just what those two programs have proven. I've got to mention here, of course, at the top, a little housekeeping. We are proud members of the 1012 network here, talking all things Big 12 over there. I'll give another, speaking of shameless plug for Dustin and I, talking to our good friend Philip over there about the Cougar football season, where it went wrong, and looking forward to how this program can be competitive in the Big 12. So give that a listen over there on the 1012 pod. Listen to them every week, talk all things Big 12 over there. And of course, we are brought to you tonight by our good friends at the good brand, homefieldapparel.com, makers of incredibly comfortable vintage collegiate apparel, including a great Houston Cougar collection I mentioned last week that I got in, a long-awaited item, finally in my size, the strutting sailor Cougar design. Really great. You would look absolutely fantastic, whoever you are, wherever you are, wearing that shirt, whether you're at a Cougar event or just doing something in your daily life. And you could save just 15%, a 15% that all you had to do for it was listen to this show on your first order by using the promo code HOLMAN12. At checkout, get some incredibly comfortable, incredibly unique vintage collegiate apparel with a great Cougar collection and hundreds of other schools, big and small there. There's not a collection out there that is deeper and better than what our good friends, the good brand Homefield Apparel, are doing. So give us a little support over there by buying some Homefield merch and using that promo code HOLMAN12. I think we should kick this off tonight with what will sadly be our final near season segment about 2022 Houston Cougar volleyball. The Cougar season, as we kind of alluded to at the top of the episode, came to an end last Thursday night in the Sweet 16 of the NCAA volleyball tournament at the hands of the Stanford Cardinal. And I think before we get into the game itself, though, I think to state the really, really obvious, this game's outcome to me wasn't super relevant to how I felt about the season. I think I'm about maxed out on how proud I could be with this team, what they've achieved this season, and more specifically, more recently, what this team has done in the postseason. I think that's been the coolest part about us doing this podcast and now going into our eighth season. You're getting to see several different programs have, you know, historic season or a run of seasons that are really unprecedented to what that program has done in many years prior. A case of women's golf, the first ever run in their first ever run of seasons, and to see volleyball have the kind of season it's had, it's really cool. And I feel like any great season is special or noteworthy, no matter the context surrounding that season. But when those great seasons are pretty unprecedented in recent history, I think that makes the team and season extra special. And I think now that we can sadly come on here, look at the season in the past tense, I think this was just an incredibly special season. And I was so zen during that game because it was kind of just like, well, whatever happens here, if we win, I'll just be over the moon about how we won. And if we lose, I'll just be over the moon that this team was one of the final 16 standing in the sport. That would have seemed like a fever dream, even in a season where I think we both had pretty optimistic expectations about what Cougar volleyball was going to be.
Yeah, I think you certainly have to be happy with the season as a whole, regardless of the outcome of one particular match, which, like you said, they could have, you know, I'm glad they didn't go out and lose, you know, 25-0, 25-0, 25-0. Obviously, they were always going to put up more of a fight than that, but they could have done that, and it really wouldn't have, you know, stopped me from feeling like the season as a whole was a huge success. They were just the ultimate definition of playing with house money at that point. Already had, you know, accomplished every, I think, reasonable and even optimistic expectation of what they could have accomplished this season. And, you know, not just talking about Cougar volleyball in their recent memory, but, you know, some of the other women's sports that we've been hoping to see kind of get to that, you know, kind of breakthrough with women's soccer not quite getting there, women's basketball kind of walking up to the precipice and not quite getting there. So I think we've seen, not just with Cougar volleyball, but with a number of sports, you know, how hard it is. And men's basketball right now is making it look ridiculously easy to just kind of come out of nowhere and become one of the best teams in the country. But even to get as far as Houston got this year, being, you know, a team that was consistently deserved to be in the top 25 and was by the end of the year, a team that made a Sweet 16 run, you know, winning a couple, not only making the NCAA postseason for the first time in a long time, but winning a couple of matches there. You know, like I said, there's no result that they could have had against Stanford that would have really tainted what a remarkable season that it's been. And as we get to the match itself, I mean, it looked for a minute there like Houston was going to do more than just appear in the Sweet 16. They jumped out to a 21-13 lead, really put a scare into the homestanding Cardinal early in the first set in this one. But Stanford did go on a 10-1 run to take over that first set and then eventually win it 26-24, and then the next two sets, Stanford just looked like, you know, one of the very most talented teams in the country. And again, certainly did embarrass Houston. You know, the Cougs put up a spirited fight in both of those second and third sets, but lost them 25-16 and 25-17. So ultimately, it's a 3-0 win to the Stanford Cardinal. And, you know, I was cheering for Houston. I was hoping absolutely that Houston would continue its magical run onto the next round. But I think we can safely say, you know, it wasn't a surprise result that Houston lost to Stanford, even that they lost in three sets. That's not a knock on the Cougs. That's a, you know, just a commentary on the way that the volleyball tournament had gone, where you'd seen this incredibly chalky tournament. We talked about last week, Houston being the only non-1-4 seed that made it to the other round of 16, and they were a 5 seed. So even there, it wasn't some huge dramatic upset. You know, and ultimately we did see, I think it was 2-1s and 2-2 seeds end up making the Final Four. Stanford actually ended up losing in 5 sets to University of San Diego.
I watched that. It was there. Really good match.
Yeah, but three of the four Elite Eight matches went 5 sets. The other one went 4. So it's been a really, really exciting tournament. But ultimately, you're seeing a lot of the ones and twos advancing, and that's, you know, Houston had just kind of gotten to the they'd done everything they could with the you know, unbelievable amount of talent and hard work and dedication that they had in that program, and just ultimately faced a team that was just a little bit better than them, Sam.
Yeah, and like you said, Dustin, really this match featured a strong start from the Cougs. They got out to that lead by as much as 21-13. In the opening set, I thought, watching this one live, the Cougs did a really good job slowing down the pace of a more athletic, definitely opponent that wanted to play this one at a faster pace. I thought exploited how Stanford maybe spaced themselves a bit in that first set, dropped a couple slowly hit balls right in the middle of no man's land. It wasn't just pure trickery, though. I thought the Cougars were genuinely outplaying the Cardinal early there. Stanford adjusted, though. Cougs would never have another situation like that 8-point lead and ultimately take the first set and the final two, kind of like you said. And I thought it was impressive. You never saw this team give up, though. I thought in what ended up being the final set of that season, you started out trading points with Stanford in the third set, ended up being 9-apiece, but you know, Cardinal go on another one of those backbreaking runs. And even though the Cougars were able to get to 5 a couple different points in that set, you could just see that this was Stanford's match. Stanford had adjusted, and you kind of realize that, oh man, this is a really good team, but I think you kind of saw the gulf between a top 15-ish team like U of H, a very, very good volleyball team, and one of the handful of very best teams in the country. I think you got to just tip your cap to this opponent there. I've watched a lot of Cougar volleyball. I'll admit this was my first time watching Stanford specifically. And that level of size and athleticism that the Cardinal had, it really just jumps off the screen at you. I mean, that a team could have a 6'5 fourth-year player like Kendall Kipp, who is Pac-12 Player of the Year, and she's just one of a handful of their most prolific offensive players, that they have a few other players, that they have a Katie Baird, that they have an Aaliyah Rubin, as well as Kendall Kipp. That's absurd. And it's absurd that Stanford has 6'6 former freshman All-American middle blocker out from October until this game. But no big deal. She has found it in herself to be back for this one. I think it's just, a reminder of an existence that the Cougars are a very good volleyball team, but this team you're facing has several future national team members on there. The announcers pointed out what seemed like 30,000 times during the game that the U.S. men's national team coach was sitting on the baseline several rows from the court. And yeah, you would assume watching one of several of the Stanford players that we saw, just a really good opponent. I thought a really good effort by the Cougars. And like you said, kind of just playing with house money at that point. And kind of cool to see the Cougars go head to head, that you were, like I said at the top, one of the last 16 teams standing, that you're in the company of this Stanford team. That's how far Cougar volleyball has gone, to go from when we started this podcast being pretty perennially bottom part of the AAC program to playing Stanford on their court at, you know, at the regional semifinals of the NCAA tournament. That is quite the jump in 7 years.
Wait, was Karch Karai there? They almost went a couple of minutes without mentioning that.
Karch Karai was there. The play-by-play guy, and Karch Karai had dinner, which he also mentioned 4 to 5 times as well. Just very important for us to know that one.
I'm glad that was repeatedly brought to our attention. But no, and you know, we talked in the preview about how Stanford, if they had any vulnerability at all, it was maybe that it was their defense. And you know, I thought Houston did what they could with that. They did a credible job offensively. You know, I thought it was kind of funny that in the during the broadcast, speaking of the broadcast, they kept, you know, repeatedly mentioning all of Houston doing the roll shots and the tip shots and everything, and kind of not going directly at Stanford's offense, and how that was, you know, offensively how they were having success. But that first set was actually Houston's worst set offensively. If you look at hitting percentage, they hit 216 in that set, which is above the national average, and they hit better than that in the other two succeeding sets as well. So, you know, offensively, it was, you know, I thought a reasonably strong performance for the Cougs against a really good team, even getting that 6'6 middle blocker back for that one. You know, you saw Isabel Toit and Cortland Henderson in their final collegiate matches, leading Houston with 9 and 7 kills respectively, both hit for good percentages. Kennedy Warren, her final collegiate match, added 6 kills as well. But you kind of mentioned it, you know, Stanford was just too good offensively. Kendall Kipp, just ridiculously good. Houston did not have an answer for her, and the Cardinal had plenty of other effective offensive weapons besides behind her and beside her as well. So just really a fearsome Stanford offensive tactic that Houston, just as good a defensive team as this has been this year for Houston, it was just a little bit too much going against a team with kind of like you said, with that many weapons. But all in all, like I said, you know, you hit 238 and on the home court of one of the best teams in the country. And, you know, you have some of those offensive weapons coming back. You know, we mentioned the three players, the three graduate seniors who all ran out of eligibility. But having a lot of players coming back from a team that that put up that kind of fight and that kind of conditions against that kind of team, I think, is not only a great commentary on the year that Houston has had, but I think is gives Houston plenty of reason for optimism as they head into the Big 12 next year.
I think that's the exciting thing. I kind of transition to looking towards the future, that all these athletes on this very good Cougar volleyball team came here to this program when moments like these were just an optimistic dream. That this team, even going to the NCAA tournament, even being in the hunt for seriously challenging UCF for the American, weren't really super realistic. And I think it's very exciting to, in the most general sense of the word, think about a future with this program, hopefully coached many more years by David Rare, recruiting to a program that's now shown itself capable of going deep in the tournament, even before you get the bump of being in a really good, exciting volleyball conference, even being in a part of the country that's certainly not short on really good volleyball recruits. I think that was kind of, as I turned off the TV after this match, I kind of thought, wow, this isn't just like a wow, there's a special season, we're gonna go back to you know, the program being outside the NCAA tournament, it felt like the end of a special season that was just the start of something. The same way, in kind of a really devastated way, I kind of felt leaving the arena in Wichita in 2018 when Jordan Poole hit the shot from Michigan. I was like, well, that's a bummer. It was obviously much more of a bummer in real time than losing to Stanford in the Sweet 16, but I thought, this doesn't feel like this is this team's last trip to the postseason. It feels like, with even losing some key pieces, that this group will be back. And I feel like this group will be back, though obviously without a few really key fifth-year players, Isabel Toit, Kennedy Warren, and Cortland Henderson, who are all using their fifth COVID season this fall. And before I get into, I think, what's left on this team that's coming back and what it could look like going forward, obviously got to talk about these three young women. Toit was certainly your standout performer, first-team all-conference. For the entire season, I would say, probably your best offensive performer. And that's really saying something, with Abby Jackson being a part of the group and Abby Jackson having quite a good season herself. That move from her to middle blocker to outside hitter, maybe the biggest reason why this team took a step to another level offensively, though I think you can't gloss over the fact that Kennedy Warren and Cortland Henderson both played big roles at big moments this season. I think no moments bigger than what those two gave you in the first two NCAA games and those really tight wins over South Dakota and Auburn. I think it's fair to say, without those two contributing what they contributed, your postseason trip might have ended after facing South Dakota. So I think, before we even get to the future, three players who will absolutely go into the history books of this program as some of the best and playing a critical role in what this team ended up being this year, and I think what this team will end up being in subsequent seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is it's a situation where you can acknowledge the, you know, incredible accomplishments and contributions of those three athletes who you mentioned, while also looking towards next year and saying, hey, you know, Houston has got a pretty good base coming back up for next year as they head into the Big 12. You know, back to back AAC libero of the year, Kate Georgiadis figures to be back, and based on who you know walked at Senior Day, we're assuming that everyone with eligibility is coming back next year for Houston, and that includes a couple of key seniors who do have that fifth year of eligibility coming back. We're talking about people like Rachel Tolles and Abby Jackson here, of course. But I mean, really, every position coming back, you have at least the basis of a good roster next year. Georgiadis at libero, both of your setter combo have eligibility left for next year, and Morgan Yanda and Annie Cook. And you know, middle blocker, even losing Isabel Toit, you've got Rachel Tolles, Kellen Morin, who really came on strong as a nice 1-2 block punch there. You know, I think your biggest, maybe really your only question mark heading into next year is finding someone else at outside hitter outside of Abby Jackson, who's, you know, amazing player, but probably not the only outside hitter you need to have on your roster heading into next year. So figuring out kind of who your second and third outside hitter there. Obviously, we got great contributions there from Cortland Henderson and Kennedy Warren this year. So without them, I think certainly there's a question there for David Rare to address in the offseason, whether that's you know, going to the transfer portal or finding someone another way. But you know, it doesn't take too many pieces coming in the offseason to imagine this being a really, really good team that could come back, you know, be very competitive in the Big 12 and make some noise in the NCAA tournament again next year.
Obviously, I preface this by saying that I don't have enough volleyball knowledge for this to actually be something I'm going to really seriously push and suggest. I'm going to put this Dustin under the category of more modest proposal. Obviously, I don't know entirely what goes into the position switch. We saw Isabel Toit move from being a quite good middle blocker to, you know, being one of your outside hitters with Abby Jackson. What about a move from Kellen Morin, who was a very good middle blocker? I'm just thinking about, what if we saw the force of kill that we saw from Kellen Morin on some of the games this year on a full-time basis? Like someone might seriously be hurt, and I think it would be terrifying and fantastic. And I mean this all in the most complimentary way possible.
I mean, did we see Isabel Toit move from middle blocker to outside hitter? I mean, I know she got more involved in the offense, but I think that was just more, I mean, I think she was still in the middle. I mean, she was still getting a lot of blocks and everything this year. And I think Kellen Morin, you know, certainly too valuable as a as a blocker to entirely write that out. But I think what we saw over the course of the season was just Houston getting more and more comfortable, not only doing those, you know, long outside passes to their outside hitters, but also to finding their middle blockers as well. So, you know, wherever she is on the court, and I imagine it'll be in the middle, and because she's 6'4", and you don't find 6'4" middle blockers just anywhere. So wherever she is on the court, you know, looking very much forward to an expanded role for Kellen Moran, I think, heading into next year. And like I said, definitely one of the key cogs that make it really easy to be really excited about this program.
Yeah, I mean, we talked earlier about the size and athleticism of an opponent like Stanford. I feel like Marin's got that more than anyone on the roster currently, and has two more years to develop at the collegiate level, which obviously is quite exciting. There are probably athletes in this program currently who were playing behind some of this year's very good group of vets that will probably, they'll play a much bigger role. The staff has done quite well in the portal too, so it'll be really exciting to see what this roster looks like in the late summer, and really exciting to look ahead to a Cougar volleyball season. It can't be overstated in a much better conference that'll provide more than two compelling games per conference season. I think that's gonna be really exciting to see what this program does in the Big 12 too.
Yeah, going from beating UCF the one time and being like, all right, now our next exciting match is like a month and a half from now when we finally play UCF again. Yeah, as opposed to a Big 12 schedule, it's going to just have big match after big match. Is going to be really, really good for the program, really, really good as a Cougar fan.
Yeah, and you still get the UCF match there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, someone like Cincinnati, who had a down year but has provided some really tough matches for Houston. You know, you got Molly Alvey, former Cougar coach there. You expect that program not to be down for too long. So, yeah, should just be a really, really strong conference top to bottom. Yeah. Yeah, BYU crazy good in that conference. So a lot to look forward to there. And then shifting gears to Cougar men's basketball, who you probably know by now, dropped one, their first loss of the season to Alabama at home on Saturday, a 71-65 final. And, you know, I think... more than anything, I think it's frustrating to have had a 15-point lead in the second half in this one and not be able to finish it off. Houston not helping themselves down the stretch, missed a lot of free throws. You know, with Tremont Mark fouled out over the last several minutes, and with Marcus Sasser playing it clearly less than 100% with that eye injury still bothering him. I think we saw this offense get stagnant in the second half. Felt like maybe Houston went into time-killing offense a little bit too early and just couldn't get back out of it again. And you know, and I think more importantly, you know, after they just relentlessly harassed Alabama in the first half, turning them over repeatedly, the Crimson Tide was the aggressor in the second half. It was I think a very rare instance since Kelvin Sampson has been here of really seeing an opponent get the upper hand and put the Cougar defense on their back foot. So you know, ultimately one loss in the season, and it's not going to be the end of the year or anything like that. But I think you have to come out and give a lot of credit to the Alabama Crimson Tide, who you know, could have easily folded down 15 points in the second half to the number one team in the country, playing against a team that has just played suffocating defense. But you know, ultimately they did not do that. They kept going, they kept fighting, handed the Cougars an L, and you know, now you take it as the learning opportunity and see what you can take away from it.
Counterpoint, Dustin, this is it. We need to shut down the program. Inconsolable that U of H lost a game this season. Okay, maybe not inconsolable. I think now with a couple days to process this game, certainly frustrating about losing this one to Bama. I think no matter the opponent, it'll be frustrating to build a lead like that, to start to feel like, wow, we're going to be able to potentially run this top 10 opponent out of the gym, which might have been a bit optimistic, certainly in hindsight, but to see it slip through your fingers and what would have been a big signature win, frustrating, but I'm certainly not as irked about it now as I was maybe at about 2:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Saturday. I think this is just what happens sometimes when you face some of the very best the country has to offer. You lose games, and I think most importantly, these games shine a light on where you need to improve as a team. If you're the kind of team like this one that is expected to be one of the last handful playing come March and early April, you got to have games like this. You got to see where your weakness is. And I hate some of how it happened specifically, because the game left, I think, some unanswerable questions about, you know, what's going to happen if you have Marcus Sasser, you're not coming off getting hit in the eye against North Florida. What happens if Tremont Mark wasn't fouled out in the game on one of the most laughably bad calls you'll see in a good long while? But I think on the whole, I still have some peace of mind for those annoyances I just mentioned, that even factoring those in, you could still look at this game and honestly say that the better team on the day won, and grudgingly, like you said, tip your hat to Bama, finding a way to win at a gym where very few teams have won ever while getting your biggest contributions from first year guys. I think it's our prerogative as fans, I guess, to just believe every loss is all about our team and what our team did. But I think we always need a reminder that usually the winning team plays a big part in winning a basketball game. And there were things I liked from this game. You held Brandon Miller, Bama's awesome freshman that we spent a ton of time talking about last week, to easily his worst game as a collegiate, which isn't to say he didn't make an impact. I thought the fact that Brandon Miller could actually reliably make free throws when very few other guys on Bama were was very important down the stretch, and very important when the crew sent Bama to the line as much as they did. But can't blame him for making the free throws he got sent there to make. But I thought on the whole, the Cougars took a guy who's a very tough matchup, a guy of his size who could shoot as well as he did, and really made him a non-factor. You went into this one trying to get guys that weren't Brandon Miller beat you, to force the Noah Clownies of the world, the Jaden Bradleys of this team, to beat you. Unfortunately, the Noah Clownies and Jaden Bradleys didn't end up beating you, but I thought the Cougars did a really good job on Brandon Miller. And I didn't maybe think this was a positive in real time, but now that I've gotten to really think about this game, I know you didn't do well rebounding the first half. It's not nothing that this group, no pun intended, rebounded from that poor first half and did a much better job limiting Bama's second chances and getting more second chances of their own. That this was a very good opponent in terms of grabbing offensive boards, and that you were able to keep them in check as much as you did. Just extra frustrating that the rebounding effort that you got in this one, even if it wasn't maybe an entire perfect 40-minute effort, wasn't accompanied with maybe a bit better of an offensive effort at times. I thought Jamal Shedd, it was impressive how willing he was to call his own number offensively when Sasser was clearly not 100%. I don't know if he has the same level of confidence that, you know, Marcus Sasser has, or if you want to go back further, Quentin Grimes, his last year here, but he showed himself willing to call his own number, and I think that's going to be important. You didn't see it get finished off, but I think you saw at times the Cougars try and figure some stuff out and actually semi-successfully do so against a really good, you know, stingy opponent defensively. The point totals might be high because Bama's a high possession team, but that's one of the very best defensive teams we're going to face this year. And you did some good stuff at times. The only problem is when it went bad, it really went bad.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important point to mention that, you know, that Houston only gets so many tests, kind of like we just talked about with volleyball. This is a program we're very much looking forward to, going from a conference where they get, you know, a couple tests maybe in conference play to one where they're going to be tested repeatedly in conference play. And like you mentioned, these are the chances that you get to find out what the very best teams in the country are going to do against you and how they're going to try to exploit you. And it's as much as we enjoy showing up and watching them, you know, just, you know, hand some overmatched team their butts and, you know, beat them by double or whatever, you know, that doesn't really tell you, you know, come March, you know, this is a team that expects to be making a late run in March, you know, come March, come the NCAA tournament, what are teams going to try to do to you? This is how you get that information is by going out there and what is your team going to do when they face someone that, like Alabama, someone you could be easily facing on the second or third weekend of the tournament. So you want to play in those games later on in the year. These are how you prepare for them early on, is by facing a team like Alabama. Would I have loved to taken that test when Marcus Sasser was at 100%? Would I have loved to have taken that test when Tremont Mark wasn't getting fouled out on a absolute BS fifth foul call? Yeah, would have loved to have taken those tests at full strength. But what did we find out last year? You don't get to take the tests at the strength that you want. You know, come March, you don't get to just choose to have all of your players 100% available and ready to go and playing at full strength. You never know. You never know what combination of players are going to be available to you at the end of the season. So that's what makes it so valuable to have a game like this, where you had to figure out, okay, what do we do offensively when Marcus Sasser's clearly just doesn't have 100% of his game there? What do we do offensively when, you know, Tremont Mark gets fouled out and we have to survive the last several minutes of the game without him? And you know, Houston kind of failed those tests in a way because, you know, they lost the game, obviously, and they kind of collapsed down in the second half after, like I said, they had that 15-point lead and really didn't do enough offensively or defensively down the stretch to make it happen. But that, like you said, that's why you play these games. Win or lose, you're going to learn a lot about yourself. You know, Kelvin Sampson said after the game, I thought early on we exposed them, and then later on they turn around and expose us back. And Houston exposed them in terms of turning them over repeatedly in the first half, and Alabama kind of turned around and exposed them back by you know, figuring out how to make an offense move against this Cougar defense that was, you know, the offense was essentially getting whatever they wanted whenever they wanted it. And honestly, for the, you know, what was it? I'm looking at it, you know, 44 points that Alabama had in the second half. They missed some open threes in the second half that, you know, I thought that if they, if a couple of those fall down, maybe this lead collapses even faster. So I think it's a game that we knew probably either way was going to give Kelvin Sampson lots to go into practice and talk to his guys about. Would have loved to have had the kind of, you know, 15 to 20 point victory it looked like we were going to get there, and would have loved to have given Kelvin Sampson the challenge of trying to figure out how to keep his guys feet on the ground and still give them things to learn from after a win. But you know, few things get people's attention, especially when you're that age, more than taking a loss and taking, you know, it's not the most humbling loss in the world. You fell from 1-5, but you no longer get to be number one team in the country. You no longer get to be undefeated. So, like I said, it's nice we've gotten to the point as a program where I think we can take a loss and say, hey, you know what, maybe it's you can start to see some of, like, the, you know, the silver linings here in terms of what it could do for this team, you know, I think for the rest of the year.
It's that old coaching adage about not wasting a loss. Kelvin Sampson is certainly not a coach to waste a loss. I want to also shout out your big man. I know maybe in a more negative light, the free throw shooting. And this one obviously was not the greatest. If you take Marcus Sasser and Jamal Shah out, the Cougars were shooting well under 50% for the charity stripe, which isn't great. But I thought the toughness of your big men, especially Jawan Roberts and Reggie Chaney, got, combining for 9 offensive boards against a super tall, super athletic, and I think most importantly, super deep Bama front court. We talked about when we previewed them that Oregon might have had a bit more raw size and obviously Invalidante, but Bama had just a larger number of guys that they could throw at you, not just, oh, this a 6'10 to 7 foot guy of questionable basketball skill. It's a bunch of 6'10 to 7 foot guys, all with some kind, you know, varying degree. Either, you know, the lowest end of that was Pringle and Charles Bediako, who are still very plus defense and rebounding guys. So, you know, I thought that you did as much as you did against this opponent, who certainly is going to show you more size than I think any opponent you're going to see the rest of the season, was still pretty impressive. And, you know, I'm not going to call it a trend yet, but we got to talk a little about the cold starts offensively. I mean, we're talking about the last 3 times U of H has now played, I would say, some degree of good opponent, which I think I'll define here as a team that's at least inside the KenPom top 100. So talking specifically about Kent State, St. Mary's, and Bama, you look at all 3 of those games, the first 10 minutes of offense has been pretty bad. You've come out a lot colder than your opponent, which, again, not going to call a trend, but feel like it's something we've seen as a commonality in 3 games where I'm not going to say you struggled exactly the same amount scoring the ball against Kent State as against Bama. You looked really good at times offensively against a Bama team that I can't overstate it is really good defensively, but you've still been kind of hit or miss at times in that one. Like you said earlier, I think the offense kind of went into kill the clock mode a little early, and then you just kind of couldn't shift up the gear, so to speak. I'm not a manual driver, Dustin. You shift gears up, right? That's how it works. But I mean, like you said, it felt like you went into the Jamal Shah dribbling at the top of the key and letting it get down to 10 seconds about 10-ish minutes before I think you probably should have, and then just couldn't ever get the half court going. I think that Marcus Sasser was never 100% healthy. I think you can't say it and say, oh, well, that puts an asterisk on Bama's win here. I think Bama very much earned that win, but you could tell the offense was kind of hard capped on what it could do, because you could tell Marcus Sasser was just never totally comfortable out there. And I think maybe to zoom in on those offensive struggles a little bit, you know, once again, didn't shoot great from 3, really didn't try it that much from 3, and the only guy who made multiple 3s got fouled out on that just absurd block charge call with over 8 minutes left in the game. Tremont Mark was the only guy who was going to be any threat from deep in this one, with Marcus Sasser clearly not being as comfortable shooting with the protective glasses on as he is normally. And I think, like you said, Bama missed some good 3-point looks. Bama didn't shoot a great 3-point percentage by any means this one. I think it just got over 30% for the game. But the tie being plus 12 on 3-pointers really feels critical in how this one ended up. I saved two things, Dustin, for last because I feel like these are more trivial. One is trivial and one is just like, I don't want to lead with blaming the officials. And it really just frustrating. It really felt at times like we were there watching Keith Kimble, Don Daly, and Doug Shouse more than we were watching UH Bama. And this is just the kind of thing that maybe the fact that we're now starting to play big games, maybe this is something that the Kansas fans or Kentucky fans of the world have been complaining about this whole time, and I just ignore them because, quite frankly, don't really care what Kansas and Kentucky fans have to say. But I feel like you get that with these big game officials, your John Huggins, your Ted Valentine, Don Daly, Doug Shouse, and Keith Kimble, all guys who, like, if you go to KenPom, and KenPom is, if nothing else, really good about analyzing college basketball data. There's a reason why KenPom and the Vegas bookmakers are mysteriously quite close on the KenPom projection versus the Vegas line. And I can tell you it's not Kenneth Pomeroy cribbing off the Vegas bookies. But he has these officials, like, all the guys that were there on Saturday, Dustin, are all in his top 30 of officials. And it's baffling to me because I feel like the crews that do our random Tuesday night games, the guys who run the Norfolk State game or the guys who run the North Florida game, actually call, and maybe it's, again, it's probably a large amount my own internal bias because that was a game we were leading by 20 points since the under 12 media timeout. But it feels like those games go quicker. It feels like I don't notice the officiating going on. I'm not saying that all these previous games have been officiated perfectly, but it just feels like whenever we get a big game like this, we get an ABC game, we get a CBS game, we get a primetime ESPN game against a big opponent, we get some referee I've never seen before who I think in this specific case was Doug Shouse, who had the game ending for Tremont Mark fifth foul call on just an absurd, just unbelievable. Even an ignoramus like me when it comes to the block charge rule is just like, that's clearly a block. I don't know how you could possibly see that as anything else. We get that. We get it every time it feels like you get some guy like Higgins or like Ted Valentine or I guess like the crew we saw on Saturday. And it's really, really frustrating. I'll save the even most trivial thing for last, but I'm giving you your space here, Dustin. What do you want to say about these officials?
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't leave with it because, you know, again, I think it's overly simplifying and overly simple to just be like, well, why do we lose? Well, we got screwed by the officials. Like, that's not a good, accurate summation of how the game is. But on the other hand, just saying like, oh, well, you know, the team that was supposed to win won, so the officiating just doesn't matter, and just kind of hand-waving it away, like, that's not really fair either. Because, like, to say that the officiating didn't have an impact on the game would be wildly incorrect. I mean, Tremont Mark should have been playing the last several. I mean, who knows? Maybe he would have picked up an honest foul the next possession. Like, it's hard to say. You know, it's impossible to say even. But like, but that was a terrible call. Like that. Like that. There are calls that are 50-50 calls that can go either way, and you get mad when they don't go your way or whatever. And it always feels like the other team gets about 90% of the 50-50 calls. That wasn't a 50-50 call. That was a wrong call. You know, Alabama repeatedly flopping in this game, and the officials even at one point reviewing it and just being like, yeah, well, there was no contact, and the guy threw his neck backwards to try to get a foul call, but that's for some reason not flopping. Like, that's a missed call. The fact that Houston was plus on points in the paint, way negative on three-point attempts, playing at home, and still was negative 10 in free throw attempts just doesn't kind of pass the smell test. And it's just frustrating anytime that it just doesn't seem like any of the whistles are going your way. It's more frustrating when, you know, you're playing the team that you lost to on a, I will very generously call a controversial call at the buzzer last year. So to have a game that literally just hinged on one single call, and whatever call they made was going to be, that was the outcome of the game, was that one call, to a game that just, you know, the first half I didn't feel like what was as, and then it just, and it, which again, the repeated thing is just, it seems like so often we see games that are called one way in the first half and then just called a different way in the second half, and called a different way once Houston got the lead. And it just, it's hard not to feel like it was the officials kind of putting their fingers, their thumb on the scale, so to speak. So yeah, not going to lead with it. And we'll open, middle, and close by saying Alabama deserved to win, and Alabama won because they kept fighting when they were down by a bunch of points, and Houston fell apart, and Alabama kept fighting, and Alabama played dramatically better over the last you know, 10 to 12, 15 minutes of this game. And that's why they won. But it is. It's you also can't just gloss over it and pretend like the officiating didn't impact the game, because it clearly did.
All right. I'm saving my most trivial thing for last. As first off, very jealous. This is not it, but very jealous that you were able to be in the building for that one. That just seemed like the most unbelievable Cougar sports atmosphere I've ever seen. It came through the TV. That was really cool. But as someone who lives 1,000 or so miles away from beautiful Fertitta Center, from the beautiful campus of the University of Houston, I had to watch this on ABC and had to watch it with my least favorite color commentator, at least favorite prominent color commentator in all of college basketball, Jay Billis. And I actually, Dustin, for this one, because it's been a good while since I've listened to a good chunk of a game that Jay Billis has called. And I was thinking, you know, maybe he caught me in a bad mood 3 or 4 years ago. I'm going to give Jay Billis a chance. I'm going to listen to this one. And it's paired with someone I really genuinely like, as a play-by-play guy, and Dan Shulman. I think Dan Shulman's quite good, versatile, could do multiple sports. Dustin, I did not make it to the first half under 8 media timeout. If we can never have a game called by that smug, insufferable, phenomenally overrated as job, Dookie, I think it will be much too soon. And maybe that was just a tiny bit of extra salt in the wound to this loss that I had to, or chose to watch the remainder of it on mute. I couldn't listen to as much of the great atmosphere that was coming through my television set, because I just didn't want the Jay Billis mixed in with it. That was just insult to injury for me. But I will just say my last thought on the game, my last non-trivia thought on the game, I think my favorite thing about the college basketball season is that it's a marathon, and that even absurdly good teams, like historically good teams, will almost always lose at least a few regular season games. And you make deep March runs in the sport by figuring out what you have to do from losses like this one. I think Kelvin Sampson, like I said earlier, certainly not one to waste a loss. And as much as there are things to work on from what we've both talked about, what we saw on Saturday and in recent games, I don't have any less confidence in this team. And I think if you're listening, you shouldn't either.
Man, tell us how you really feel about Jay Billis, Sam.
He's absolutely terrible.
I'm pretty sure he's in our intro to this podcast for someone that you dislike that much. I'm pretty sure that's him saying that's NBA stuff right there, that Marcus Sasser is a baller from the Virginia game a year ago. So maybe I shouldn't have tipped you off that I put him in our intro. But that's sorry for rooting it for you.
It's fine. If you make two of the clips Jay Billis, I think we're gonna have to have an issue. But you know what? No, it's fine. It's a good clip. You know, a broken clock is right twice a day, I guess.
I feel like in the minority, because he inspires so much hatred online, and you know, I don't know.
It's weird because it's not NCAA stuff. I am absolutely 100% with him on all of his NCAA stuff. I bet if you looked at Jay Billis's opinions and my opinions on stuff, it would probably be pretty similar. It has not anything to do with that. I just cannot stand him, and I cannot even give you a really rational reason why.
Fair enough. But yeah, my only, you know, thought was my last bullet point here was something that we kind of, for the game, was something we kind of already talked about, which is just, it's not the end of the world. You know, it's a loss to a really good team, in December. And, you know, this is a Houston team that was, as much as we all would have liked to think that that was within the realm of possibility, a team that was probably never going to go undefeated for the entire season. And you know, this is a program that we've seen, year on year on year, under Kelvin Sampson, the team is better in February and March than it is in November and December. So, you know, it is a game we would have all loved for it to go a different way. We would have all loved for Noah Clowney to not quite be so good. We would have all loved for the whistles to go a little bit different. We'd have all loved for Marcus Sasser to be healthy and playing better than he was. But ultimately, it's something that you take the lessons away from, and it's not something that at the end of the year you're going to be majorly dinged because you lost a single game in December to a really, really good team. So we did mention in the last episode that Houston will be hosting North Carolina A&T on Tuesday. This was already a team that Houston was going to beat comfortably, with the motivation of coming after a loss. I do not envy the Aggies as they head to the Fertitta Center tomorrow evening. And then, more interestingly, I think a game we have not talked about yet that we definitely do want to talk about is when Houston will hit the road on Saturday to face the University of Virginia. You may remember the Cougs embarrassed the Cavaliers last year at the Fertitta Center. This team, UVA team, will be out for revenge, And after a down year last year, they are one of the teams in the country with the most returning production, and they've turned that into a major improvement. They're 8 on the year. They beat Baylor and Illinois and Vegas. They beat Michigan and Ann Arbor. They're number 2 in the AP poll this week. So definitely huge, huge test for the Cougs on the road. No time to sulk about that Bama loss, because you got your other of your two marquee matchups on the schedule coming up on Saturday, Sam.
Yeah, and despite that disappointing year last year, like you said, Virginia comes into the season as one of the highest-ranked teams in the sport, one of the very few left that are still undefeated. You mentioned the true road win against a good Michigan team, also good neutral site wins against Baylor and Illinois back in November. They returned all of last year's starting lineup completely intact, one of the oldest teams in the sport. Other than Isaac McNeely, they don't have anyone that I've seen who's in their rotation playing meaningful minutes that's younger than a junior. I think the most familiar name for Cougar fans has got to be Jaden Gardner, a fifth-year guy at this point. Dustin, it feels like just yesterday we were talking about ECU freshman sensation Jaden Gardner. Cougar fans saw him be for three seasons a very, very good player on varying degrees of pretty bad ECU teams before transferring to UVA prior to last season. Obviously, going to be a lot of familiarity with Gardner among the current players and coaching staff. Still, familiarity, I think, and knowing how to solve the guy aren't the same. I would say what concerns me the most about him is that he is so good at getting to the free throw line. Hasn't really shot it very well from the free throw line, but I think even an ability to potentially get key Cougar players in foul trouble could be big in a game that could be really low scoring, really tight margins kind of game. The Cavaliers are really good just as a team generally at getting to the free throw line. A little bit better as a team than Gardner, but they're not really that good making the free throws. Are currently 167th in the nation. But again, like I said, you can change a game just simply by getting a lot of, you know, opponents, key guys in foul trouble if you are as good as Virginia is at getting to the line. Also, just on the defensive end, a really, really good team at not fouling on defense and not sending opponents to the line a bunch. So expect a pretty gaudy, I'd say, margin at the free throw line for the homestanding Cavaliers. And Gardner, I think, another key thing he does that I wanted to highlight here, he's a great offensive rebounder on a Virginia team that just by its style is not going to crash the glass. They're going to place a much higher priority on getting back in transition. So if Jaden Gardner can steal a few extra possessions and what'll be a low possession, close score kind of game potentially, that could be a deciding factor. In this one, they also bring back Kihei Clark, a diminutive multi-year starting point guard. I think I'll be excited to see how him and Jamal Shedd go head-to-head. And I wanted to mention also with Virginia, they play a really unique defense. It's called the Pack Line under their head coach, Tony Bennett. It was largely created by his father, who was a longtime college head coach, Dick Bennett. And I'm not going to spend the next 30 minutes droning on about the Pack Line, but it's one of the most effective defenses out there, really good at preventing opponents from getting dribble penetration, getting close to the basket, getting those more high-percentage shots. Kind of functions like a zone, but would be accurate certainly to call it a zone defense. I think I saw someone call it a sagging man-to-man. That seems right to us. And feel free to talk over me, because you certainly have more history with basketball X's and O's than yours truly. I think, long story short, UH is going to have to do something that I don't know that we've seen this team do really consistently against good opponents this year, and that's make shots from deep. That's really have good ball movement, reverse the ball when needed, and I think above all else, just make difficult contested shots.
Yeah, it's certainly anytime you play a zone defense or a sagging man defense or whatever you want to call Virginia's pack line defense, it puts a premium on shooting and making outside shots to penalize them for sagging off of you. And that's something that we've seen Houston only do, you know, inconsistently well. We've seen stretches where this team can certainly hit some shots from outside, and we know that Marcus Sasser, when healthy, is a threat from outside. Tremont Mark can shoot the three. Jamal Shedd, you know, not afraid to shoot a three-pointer. So, Jairus Walker, certainly not afraid to shoot a three-pointer, although I think we've seen that maybe reined in a little bit from where he was at the beginning of the year. But like I said, this is a defense that is really going to kind of, you know, they're not going to give you open threes, but they're going to give you the semi-contested three. And if Houston can hit those semi-contested threes, that's, you know, that's a huge factor. And it's something that we saw against Alabama, where the threes weren't falling early, and the Cougs essentially gave up on even really trying to shoot them. I think all three of Houston's threes in that game were made within, like, what was it, the last 30 seconds of the first half, and then the first, like, minute or two of the second half. And other than that, Houston didn't hardly shoot any threes. So we're going to be very intrigued to see, is Houston willing to shoot more threes than they have been? Do they feel forced into shooting that? You know, are we going to see an offense that is more active than we saw certainly at the end of the Alabama game? Because it's going to, you know, they're going to have something figured out playing a defense as good as Virginia's on their own court. Yeah, you mentioned Jaden Gardner, a guy who I just assume will somehow be facing Houston again next year, as is now the fifth year in a row that the Cougs have had to face the guy. But, you know, really, really good player, but it's an incredibly well-balanced offensive attack. You mentioned they returned their entire starting lineup, all five of those guys averaging between 9 and 12 points per game right now, so it's not like it's just Gardner or just one guy leading that attack, but definitely the things that scare you about Virginia, you mentioned it. They get to the line a ton. They were plus 21 in free throw attempts in a 7-point win over Baylor. They were plus 23 free throw attempts in a 9-point win over Illinois, plus 9 even on the road in a 2-point win over Michigan. This is a Houston team that we know that's kind of been always their Achilles heel defensively under Kelvin Sampson, has been that they can send their opponents to the line a lot. And it's something that the first several games of the season, they had, you know, been better than the last several years, but we certainly kind of saw it rear its ugly head in the Alabama game. So a absolutely huge, huge test as the UVA, one of the best teams in the country at getting to the line and getting there repeatedly. Although, as you mentioned, the free throw percentage, not always so high. But, you know, the other thing kind of scary about them offensively is just that they shoot threes at a real high percentage, and the Cougs are still number three in the country at 3-point percentage defense. But kind of like we talked about, I feel like they've maybe looked a little bit less impossible to get some open looks against from outside in the last couple of games, in the Alabama game specifically. This is definitely a Houston team that is not giving up a low number of 3-point attempts. It's just been the 3-point shooting of their opponents that's been very low. So I'm very intrigued to see, is Houston going to be able to stay in, you know, UVA's faces, put hands on in faces as guys are getting shots up from deep, or is this maybe the game where, you know, we kind of see a team finally get hot from outside, sustained over the course of a full game? Because like I said, going against the UVA defense, if they're hitting shots from the outside and getting to the line, that's a scary proposition, to be sure.
For sure. It's not all bad news to the Cougars, though, because of that pack line. UVA is never a great offensive rebounding team, and for this specific UVA team, they've also struggled, I think, relative to that program's historic performance under Tony Bennett, at keeping opponents from grabbing offensive boards. That's not necessarily something that's a result of the pack line. I think it's just this personnel grouping. These just isn't a good team at keeping opponents from grabbing offensive boards, which is obviously good news for your Cougars, given how this team crashes the glass. And we'll say, UVA is a really good team, deserving of being in the top five. But I'll also say, I don't know if this team is going to challenge the Cougs in the same way that Bama did. They're going to be coming this one on almost 2 weeks of that game. I think they're on a final exam break right now. And it could be a refreshing break, or it could be we see an opponent who has a lot of rust facing a Cougar team that is going to be pretty focused after that loss last Saturday. It's really impossible to say at this point. We'll say UVA wasn't playing their best basketball a week or two before that break. They barely beat FSU and James Madison at home. And I think the narrative angle in this one is interesting. You know, of course, Virginia's players will remember last season's beatdown in Houston, but this is the first time this year the Cougs are going to be going to a game as the lower-ranked team, as maybe the betting line underdog, as maybe at least a hair more the hunted rather than the hunter. And it's kind of an unfamiliar place to be, and I'm kind of excited about it, Dustin. You could actually, for the first time this year, legitimately go in the locker room and say, hey, they think that team is better than you. They think that team that you beat down last year is better than you. Go prove them wrong. You can't really play that chip on your shoulder when you're the number one team in the country like this team has been, or when you've been a fairly good favorite, which you've been to some degree basically every game before this one. So I think that'll be exciting to watch, though obviously can't overlook the fact that I'm sure Virginia spent a lot of the last 12 months thinking about how they really got beat in an uncharacteristic way when these teams last met in Houston.
Yeah, you know, I think to take, you know, kind of one last look at it in terms of, you know, from an analytical standpoint, you know, like I said, we talked about the things that scare you. You kind of mentioned some of the things that you like. They don't rebound well on either end of the ball. They don't have a ton of size outside of, you know, 6'11 shot blocker Caden Shedrick. Outside of him, they don't block a ton of shots. They get their shot blocked a lot. Houston has blocked a ton of shots this year. So I think we're going to see, you know, if they're not getting open threes, I think when this Virginia team goes inside, you know, they might have a hard time getting shots off over a Cougar defense that's been pretty good at deflecting shots. So I think you certainly like that there. You certainly like I said, the how much they struggle on the glass. That's somewhere where Houston is. And that's a particular area where we saw them, like I said, got their butts handed to them on the glass in the first half against Alabama, kind of, you know, rebounded in the second half. And that's I think, one particular area where Houston is going to be motivated to really show out. And then my other X factor is something that you mentioned there a little bit as well, which is that this is going to be Virginia's first game in 11 days, you know, whereas Houston will be playing its second game of the week for the third straight week that they'll have had two games. And, you know, I think it is notable. Alabama came into last Saturday's game with a full week of rest while Houston didn't have as much rest. And notably down the stretch, it felt like Alabama looked like the more well-rested team. So, you know, do we see a repeat of that in Charlottesville on Saturday, or is this a Virginia team coming out looking a little rusty? Is 11 days in a row too many days off over a finals break there? You know, I think that that's going to be a big factor, and hopefully, you know, we don't see Houston kind of do what you talked about earlier, which was coming out with the slow offensive start. And so, you know, facing a team in its own building, it's always hard to score in someone's own building. It's hard to score against Virginia in their own building, certainly. But you know, hopefully this is nonetheless a team that Houston will be able to come out, have some momentum, and have some, like I said, something to prove, you know, like being the lower ranked team. And, you know, as much as we talk about Virginia, this being a revenge game for them, you know, they weren't a great team last year, so, you know, they lost to a few teams last year, so I don't know if, you know, this is going to be the only game, you know, they're going to be motivated to beat Houston because they lost last year, or they might be motivated to beat, you know, Clemson and Wake Forest and NC State and Florida State and some other teams like that, too, because they lost a bunch of games. They weren't that great last year, so, you know, it's maybe a little bit harder to work it up as a revenge game from that side if, you know, you have a lot of those on the schedule this year. Whereas, like you said, for Houston, I think it's a very good talking point for Kelvin Sampson going into this one. Like you said, hey, we beat this team last year. It's the same guys there. We have a lot of the same guys here. You know, let's go out and beat them again and prove that that we deserve to be the higher ranked of these two teams. So should be a really, really fun matchup, and a matchup that, like I said, if Houston can pull that one off, I think that's going to put a lot of the sting of the Alabama loss behind them pretty quickly. And then the Cougs, I guess we'll talk about it because I'm not sure if we're going to have another episode by next Wednesday. So I'll very briefly mention it, which is as much mention as it really deserves, that the Cougs will be hosting McNeese State next Wednesday. The Cowboys are, according to Ken Pom, the worst team on Houston's schedule this year. They're currently ranked 351st out of 363 division teams. They actually do have a pair of wins over D1 competition this year, beating Lamar at home and a upset win at Northern Iowa. But notably, this looks like UNI's worst team in a very long time. Lamar is very bad. And every time McNeese has gotten near a team with a pulse, they've gotten pulverized. Baylor beat them by 29, Tennessee beat them by 36, Iowa State beat them by 37, even Tulane beat them by 17 earlier in the year. So they do grab a lot of offensive rebounds. They got a couple of sophomore guards scoring in double figures, but not a McNeese team that is going to have nearly enough about them to challenge the Cougs.
They're bottom 20 nationally in offensive and defensive efficiency. Yeah, that's... it's not great. You want to generally be better than
could be better.
Well, you want to be at least like not bottom 20 in one of those. Ideally two, but certainly both. And I think we've talked about this one as much as it deserves to be talked about.
All right, and then do you want to talk about some Cougar women's hoops who faced Rice and fell in double overtime on Saturday by a final score of 91-88. The Cougs dropping a thriller. Jumped out to a 10-point halftime lead in this one, but the Owls rallied, and over the last several minutes of regulation, we saw the teams trade leads. Houston actually trailed by 4 points with 30 seconds left, but Layla Blair got to the line, hit a couple of free throws. The Cougs forced a turnover. Tatiana Hill got fouled, hit a couple of free throws. Houston was able to force the extra period, and in that first overtime period, we saw again, you know, kind of a similar repeat of the last, you know, several minutes of regulation with the teams trading leads. Only this time it was the Owls who got to the line in the closing seconds to force the second overtime period. And in that second overtime, we finally saw the Owls grab some separation. They jumped out to an 8-point lead and held off the Cougar comeback attempt over the last couple of minutes there. So, you know, Houston had one of its better offensive performances of the season. This one shot over 40% from the floor, had a rare good shooting night from the charity stripe, including the clutch moments there, like we talked about at the end of regulation, and five different Cougs all got into double figures. But, you know, defensively allowed the Owls to shoot over 55% from the field. Guard Destiny Jackson just repeatedly got to the lane with ease, shot 12 of 14 from the floor, plus 9 of 10 from the free throw line for 33 points. Rice, 52 points in the paint as a team, just scoring inside pretty much at will. Houston was able to force 25 turnovers, but anytime they didn't turn Rice over, the Owls seemed to score pretty easily. So not to sound too repetitive in the way we talk about this Cougar women's basketball team, you know, but I feel like I say this every week, devoid of context, losing this game, you know, against double overtime to a team that's on the borderline of the top 25, you know, not that bad when it's your rival and you're losing to fall to 2-8 on the year. It kind of just feels, Sam, like another example of Houston finding a way to lose.
Yeah. And like you said, it's frustrating because this wasn't one where you shot poorly. It was one where something we've talked about repeatedly is just, hey, this team doesn't really shoot that well from the free throw line, and more importantly, just doesn't get there very often. Not the case here. You got to the line nearly as much as your opponent and shot it quite well when you did. Shot it well at key moments, I think very important there, but it's just frustrating. It's another week where you finally saw this team get really close. You saw this team do well things they've struggled to do, but just couldn't overcome in some key areas. I think something really critical here is that both Tatiana Hill and Cameron Jones, I would say two of your most effective rebounding and defense post players, both fouled out of this one, both fouled out without having played that many minutes. I think that certainly probably contributed to that. Certainly, not probably. There's no such thing as certainly probably. That certainly contributed to the Rice 52 points in the paint that you said earlier. And it's not just one of those situations where you can say, oh, well, they're 2-8 because they're a bad basketball team. I mean, it's 2-8 with, what was it? It's four overtime losses now. Was that three? Hold on, Florida.
I think it's just three. The Florida schools, Rice, right?
So three of your eight losses being overtime is pretty absurd, and none of those three were against bad teams. I mean, you've played two bad teams this year. You beat them both comfortably. You played eight varying degrees of decent to good team, and you've lost all of them. And that's frustrating. As much as you could say this team's not playing badly, you have to be able to get over the hump. At some point, just unfortunately, didn't happen at Tudor Fieldhouse, despite having a real close call of it on Saturday.
And then, in our last episode, we talked about the Cougs facing Middle Tennessee on Wednesday, so you can check out our last episode for some more detailed thoughts. But I can tell you, after beating a top 20 Louisville team by 18 in the game that has happened since that episode, they stomped Memphis on the road on Saturday. So it continues to look like a really challenging tough for the Cougs from the Blue Raiders on Wednesday, when Houston will be on the road for that one. They will return home to the friendly confines of the Fertitta Center on Monday, when they'll be hosting UTSA. And on a Houston schedule that doesn't have too many quote-unquote easy games, like we talked about, this is maybe about as close as you're going to get for the Roadrunners. Stand at 2-5. Their only wins coming over some very bad Abilene Christian and Idaho teams, and they did get blown out by a mediocre Missouri State team, but that's the only loss of theirs that wasn't close. They gave SFA all they could handle in Nacogdoches. It's a good SFA team. They gave St. John's all they could handle at a neutral site in Vegas. Pretty good St. John's team as well. So, you know, even a 2-5 UTSA team, you know, you're 2-8, so I guess you can't take them lightly either. And in terms of what you want to do here, you know, forward Jordan Jenkins leading the team at over 18 points a game, so stopping her, certainly job number one. The Roadrunners have turned it over plenty this year, and that, like we've talked about, that's been a Houston strength, is turning opponents over. So I think leaning into a big turnover margin has to be job number two, and hopefully if Houston does those things, they can pick up win number three on the year, or, you know, number four if they can, optimistically enough, they can knock off the Blue Raiders on Wednesday.
Yeah, I think you've covered most of the big points. They are coached by longtime veteran, former Longhorn head coach, Karen Aston, which I think was a nice get for them. She's accomplished a lot in the women's game and says something for UTSA that she was willing to take the job there and rebuild that program going into a tougher league here coming up next season.
And then since we do usually record on Wednesdays, I'll go ahead and throw out next Wednesday's game, since that one might well be over by the time we come back to you. The Cougs hosting Washington State next Wednesday. The other Cougs stand at 7-2 on the year as of recording time, with losses to Washington and BYU, neither of those very good teams. They do have a couple of nice wins over some decent mid-majors in San Francisco and South Dakota State. And just, you know, interesting, very international flavor to this Washington State team. Their top six players all hail from outside the U.S. New Zealand guard Charlize Leger-Walker is averaging better than 22 points per game. Certainly the focus of your scouting report there. 6'3 Rwandan center Bella Mura Katete as a force inside, and then your other starters are from Canada, Estonia, and Australia. Your top sub is from Kosovo, so loving the little model UN that Wazoo is running here, and certainly another team that, like most of the ones on Houston's non-conference schedule, look like they're going to provide a tough challenge for the Cougs.
Yeah, this is one of those ones I had circled before the season. They were a 2022 NCAA tournament team, and maybe not having the strong start of it, like another last year tournament team like Kansas State, but still going to be a very tough opponent. It would be a huge, huge win if the Cougars can get it. I'm not super optimistic about it.
Yeah, those are Houston's last three non-conference games. They're at Middle Tennessee, home versus UTSA, home versus Washington State. So, you know, for a team that only has two wins, you certainly would like to pick up one or two more if you can before you get into your conference slate. And I think that is where we're going to go ahead and leave it. So on our way out, we want to encourage you, if you haven't already started listening to some of those Scott and Holman Patreon premium episodes, we've put out a couple of those already. Would love for you to go to shpodcast.com/support. You'll find a link to our Patreon. You can pledge any dollar amount from $1 on up per month. That'll not only be tremendously appreciated by Sam and myself for the effort that we put in each week, but also, like we've talked about, we've got a couple premium episodes already out. We got plenty more ideas for premium episodes to be released in the future. So if you like the Scott and Holman podcast, you want to support us, and you want even more Cougar Talk in your life, would love you to go to shpodcast.com/support. Click on that link to our Patreon, make a recurring donation there. If that's all too much for you, you can always send us a one-time tip on PayPal, also at that same URL. You can also buy some merchandise with our street sign logo on it. You can also get in contact with us. You can email us, shpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet at us at shpodcast and feed our ever-growing Twitter degeneracy. That's it for us. Kudos to you if you made it all the way to the end. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. No cap. No cap. No.